Warning, the Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Years, Barack Obama sat in his pew listening to his pastor.
And then wants us to sing God Bless America? No, no, no. Not God Bless America. God damn America. That's in the...
Now Beth Perdue and Richard Moore endorse Barack Obama. They should know better. He's just too extreme for North Carolina.
The North Carolina Republican Party sponsored this ad opposing Beth Perdue and Richard Moore for North Carolina governor.
Now, that is an ad playing in North Carolina against Democrat candidates for governor. But take a guess who opposes the ad. Well, certainly the Democrats, because it exposes Obama for who he is. But no, you guessed wrong. It's Tom McCann, shoe salesman, denouncing the very TV ad that could launch him into the presidency, which apparently he doesn't really want. Listen to a Tom McCann, shoe salesman, now.
There's no place in the Republican Party for the kind of ad that was put up by the North Carolina Republican Party. We communicated with them in the strongest possible terms not to run that ad. I cannot in my role dictate to the North Carolina Republican Party what their message is, but I can condemn it and I can appeal to the overwhelming majority of Republicans in the state of North Carolina who also repudiate that kind of activity. I'm calling on them to repudiate the people, the small handful of people that have refused to understand that we are the party of Abraham Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt, and Ronald Reagan. And that party, that Republican Party, there's no room for this kind of activity. I do not have any further options. I cannot enforce my will on people who are the elected representatives of their party, but I can make it clear to them that I will have no part of it, and I'm confident that the Republican Party, the average Republicans in the state of North Carolina, would repudiate such things.
Now, McCain should have repudiated Reverend Wright all over again instead of repudiating the Republican Party in North Carolina for calling it exactly the way it is, in my opinion. I believe that McCain is indicating his weakness, and I think that McCain is indicating that he's not strong enough for this job. If he will not repudiate a racist preacher and he will not repudiate his competitor, how can he repudiate Osama bin Laden? And that's my question to you. 1-800-449-8255 is the opening question. Do you think McCain is wrong or right for repudiating this ad? Now, here's the second story, and it's a little difficult for me to read this story because it's so heartbreaking. It's linked up from the Boston Globe on michaelsavage.com. This is a terrible story. There was a boy 10 years old who was raped by two men, two homosexual beasts, who lured him into a car, killed him, with a gasoline-stuffed rag in his mouth, raped him while he was dead, and then disposed of his body in the river. This happened a number of years ago. He was befriended by two sick homosexuals in his East Cambridge neighborhood, murdered when he resisted their attempted sexual assault. This little boy fought for 20 minutes, according to coroners. The murderers, the rapists, the psychos, were given life sentences. But the parents went ahead after the horrible tragedy or crime against their son, and they sued. They filed a federal lawsuit against a vile organization called the North American Man-Boy Love Association and 18 reputed members of the North American Man-Boy Love Association. The North American Man-Boy Love Association, which was represented by the American Civil Liberties Union, defended this group of vile, disgusting scum, and they won. Today, the ACLU has defended the vile, disgusting scum in the North American Love Association, saying that that's free speech. And the parents, the heartbroken parents, had to drop the lawsuit because the devils in the ACLU got them off. The lawyer for the ACLU said there was nothing illegal about the magazines advocating sex between men and boys, and that the magazines were legal and they're available in bookstores. And the lawyer, Miss Wunsch, W-U-N-S-C-H, said there was never any evidence that NAMBLA was connected to the death of Jeffrey Curley. It's been our view that for the last 8 years, it's been the First Amendment that's been the defendant in this case. So in other words, let me see if I understand this. The Founding Fathers envisioned that at some time, several hundred years down the road, the First Amendment was written to protect two fat homosexuals who wanted to rape a young boy. Is that freedom? Is that what it's all about? Is that what your ancestors died at Gettysburg for? Is that what your ancestors died in the First World War, the Second World War, to defend fat homosexuals and their rights to read magazines which promote raping little boys? Look, this country is out of control. I have to be the one to tell this to you? The little boy was abducted in East Cambridge after he was lured into a car driven by a neighborhood resident, two residents, who promised the little boy a new bicycle. When one of the pigs made sexual advances toward the boy fought back in a struggle that authorities said lasted for 20 minutes. The little boy fought for his life. The slob subdued and smothered the little boy, stuffing a gasoline-soaked rag into his face. The child's body was then sexually assaulted in Jane's apartment in Manchester, New Hampshire, before he and his friend placed a victim in a 50-gallon plastic container, filled it with lime and concrete, and dumped it into a river in southern Maine. After the slaying was solved, the outcry in Massachusetts and Robert Curley's public anger, that's the father, propelled the legislature to within one vote of reinstating the death penalty. Well, what happened was after that, in May of 2000, the parents filed a federal suit alleging that one of the men obtained materials for the North American Man-Boy Love Association and, quote, became obsessed with having sex with and raping young male children, close quote. The Curleys received legal support from the Thomas More Law Center, but the rapists were defended by the ACLU. So that's the America that you live in. That's the America that you live in. Those are the parents who have to live with this crime forever. The question to you in this case is, should the United States of America permit an organization like NAMBLA to exist? This is the Savage Nation. Two topics. Is McCain tough enough for the job? Was he right to repudiate the Obama ad, the Obama right connection, really? And the second question is, I can't even ask the question because it's a moot point. Of course NAMBLA shouldn't exist. In a sane society, you know what should be done to the members of NAMBLA. You know exactly what should have been done from the day it was formed. The prisoners, for example, who are, let's take some of our worst prisoners who are not child molesters, just the really bad people, violent men. They're in Pelican Bay. They're in some really bad prisons across America. Why is it, do you think, that they seek out child molesters and mutilate them if they can get their hands on them in prison? Is it that they have a better code of honor and justice than you do? Is it the fact that the men in prison have a better code of honor than our politicians do? Think about it. Why is it that the men in prison will seek out a child rapist and kill him if they find them in jail, while our politicians will actually protect them? Our courts will protect the child rapist. Is it more civilized inside Pelican Bay than it is inside K Street? I'll let you figure it out. I'll be right back. Savage. Well, I was never enamored of John McCain ever since the McCain, Feingold, McCain, Kennedy. I know he tried to reinvent himself, but, you know, you can only reinvent yourself so far. The man who he had become a long time ago keeps, I guess, seeping out. Here he has a victory in Pennsylvania for Hillary based upon attack ads by the Hillary machine. Attack ads that weren't made up, by the way. Nobody put these words in the mouth of Obama's pastor. and it raised very serious questions about Obama's internal landscape. Real questions. How many times do I have to say the same thing to you? What if a Republican went to a church, and in the church there was a preacher, and the preacher was a part-time Ku Klux Klan member who at night burned crosses, and the media said, this shows that this man, this Republican, is not capable of being a president because his preacher was a member of Ku Klux Klan. Then what would the Republicans say? Well, I didn't know he burned crosses at night. They said, well, he baptized two of your children. He married you. Right, but I never saw him burn any crosses. Would you think that would fly? Of course it wouldn't. And yet we're supposed to turn our head away and say Obama has no relationship to this racist preacher. It's a very big story. All right, so the Republicans run the ad showing Reverend Wright. They run it against Democrats. And take a guess who defends John McCain. Instead of attacking Reverend Wright, he attacks the Republicans in North Carolina. I mean, this is insanity. Gene, welcome. You disagree. Tell us why.
Okay, I think I believe Senator McCain is right in one respect. Okay, I believe the conservatives he knows will not fail to vote for him because they're not going to go to the Democrat Party. Of course, the other thing is because he thinks if he says this now, it will help him with the independent voters, and in the general election, it will appeal to more people. And if the Republicans want to win, they have to do that. And I could be
so. So what you're saying is this is a calculated compromise on the part of John McCain.
Yes.
That he's not a man of principle.
Well, he is.
He's compromising his principles in order to win the office. Is that what you're saying?
Well, wait. Let me ask you: would you, of the three people, would you want to see him in? Because of the other.
At this point, I'm not sure anymore. I don't think that I don't really know if I would want McCain in. I don't think I'm going to vote for him. Yeah. The more I see of him, the less I like of him.
So who would you want in?
I'm not sure. I don't know if I want Bush 3.
Well, what about the other two? Would you want one of those?
I'm not sure. Hillary may be a better president than John McCain. I'm not sure at this point. I don't know.
And Clinton's?
I just said what I said. Hillary came out stronger in her statement about Iran than McCain has. In every position, McCain is a compromised individual. He doesn't make any strong statements along the lines of what I want to hear. What's he going to do to protect us against the real enemies if he won't even attack the enemy within? Why are you so enamored, let's say, of John McCain? What is it about him that attracts you to him? Because he's a Republican?
In a lot of respects, I agree with you. I don't think he is the strongest candidate for the Republican Party. But I believe at this point, since there is no other candidate, I think what he's using...
So wait, but look what we got from compromising and accepting George Bush for the last 7 years. We had the same strategy foisted upon us by the two-party system. Well, Bush is the lesser of two evils in 2000 against Al Gore, and he was the lesser of two evils against John Kerry in the year 2004. And look where we are today, for God's sakes.
Well, no, I agree with you about that, but I'm also looking at the other side. I'm looking at the other two candidates.
So, in other words, compromise is king, and John McCain is the king of compromise. So you love him. Thank you for the call. That's what I just heard. I guess this is why I'm not made for the world of politics. It could be that I'm too, I don't even have the right word. I see things the way they are, and I say them the way they are. In that sense, I'm not a politician. I don't know how you can keep changing your stripes every day of the week to appeal to different factions. I don't know how you can do this. Now, the other issue is another one that's very hard for you to talk about. Parents of slain boy dropped lawsuit against the North American Man-Boy Love Association, and the North American Man-Boy Love Association was defended by the vile scum in the ACLU. No one has anything to say about that? I could just drop that story. Los Angeles, Michael, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hey, Dr. Savage. Historically speaking, when the civilization starts accepting homosexuality and, man-boy love, whatever you want to call it, isn't it pretty much the beginning of the end of that civilization? You know, I'm thinking
yes.
about...
Yes, every civilization that accepted homosexuality as a norm disappeared soon thereafter, and I can name five in a row. Yes, that's true. That is true. And our politicians, as you know, have given up on the culture war. You know that, Michael. Very few people will stand up to the homosexual propagandists today. not only because they run the media, but because they fundamentally have brainwashed an entire generation into thinking it's just a lifestyle choice. You know that as well as I do.
Michael, I tell you, I think we're well into our decline, but I will say...
Well, Michael, let me ask you this, and I'll level with you on this. How old are you?
46.
Okay. I'm over 50. I believe that people under 40 see nothing wrong with homosexuality. They have grown up in schools over the last 20 years, or excuse me, 20. They went to school in the 60s, some of them, as kids. They then were subjected to a relentless homosexual propaganda by the major media for the last 25 years. Consequently, they are now brainwashed into thinking that kind of physical behavior is equal to that of their grandparents. So it is a generational thing. I admit it. The younger people are basically in tune with that death style. For example, how often have you seen young sluts, so-called celebrities, shown kissing each other inside a so-called nightclub in Hollywood? It's shown as the very, very, hot thing to do. Yep. Now, I know most women over 40, their stomachs turn at the thought of women tongue-kissing each other, to be honest with you. Okay? Let me level with you. But now, what does this have to do with the two homosexuals who raped and killed this boy? Everything. Because it's all connected on one long arc. Don't you agree with me?
Absolutely. And I was just going to say that. I think that the society that celebrates homosexuality is going insane. The same way that the civilization that will say, well, we got to take McCain because, we don't want Hillary or Obama. Michael, you know what? I'm sick and tired of this lesser of two evils garbage.
What? Well, there you go. Everything is a compromise. So we live in a compromised nation in an uncompromising world, and that's what worries me. We're going to get run over in the future that's coming because China's not a compromising nation. Iran is not a compromising nation. But we have a bunch of compromising sellouts on K Street, and I'm afraid they'll get us run over. That's what I'm worried about. I want a strong driver on the racetrack of life. I don't want one of these equivocators who's going to say, I'm not really sure I'm ready for the race. I just want to win, sitting in a car that's idling. This is the Savage Nation. This is the Savage Nation. You know the phone number, you know the website, and I'll be back to take your calls on these and other topics right here.
The president that a Palestinian state is a high priority for me and my administration. A viable state, a state that doesn't look like Swiss cheese, a state that provides hope. It's in, I believe it's in Israel's interest and the Palestinian people's interest to have leaders willing to work toward the achievement of that state. The president's a man of peace, a man of vision. He rejects the idea of using violence to achieve objectives, which distinguishes him from other people in the region.
I am I'm gasping because I can't believe what I'm listening to. I told you that if you weren't happy with George Bush's presidency thus far, you've seen nothing yet. That between now and when he leaves office, he's going to ratchet up the damage he does to the world at a geometric pace. And I'm convinced now that he wants to see the creation of a Palestinian nation before he leaves office somehow for his deranged view of a legacy. I mean, it would be very nice to see two peoples who have been warring for centuries, actually for ages, living side by side in peace. I would love that. But I am not enamored of the fact that Gaza was given back to the Palestinians and they've been shooting rockets from Gaza. If that wasn't the peace gesture, I'd like to know what was. Now you say, well, is that inevitable? No, the Jewish state gave back the Sinai to Egypt, and they've had a long, long peace since that was done. But the Egyptians are a little different than the Palestinians, at least the Palestinian leadership. You know, when you say the Palestinians, who are you referring to? You're referring to the madmen who run the Palestinian operations. The average person is a very intelligent, peace-loving person who wants to get on with his life. And everybody knows that. You ask any Arab, And they will tell you that the Palestinians are the most intelligent of all of the Arab people. I know that for a fact because I went to graduate school and I've met an awful lot of people when I did. And everybody knows that in the Arab world, the Palestinians are known to be the smartest people and they're also the most feared. But putting that aside, I don't see how there can be two states. Maybe you want to talk about that. Or you want to go back to the other issues that we're talking about, John McCain, the shoe salesman, compromising by attacking the North Carolina Republican Party for exposing the Democrats, you know, for how they are. Now, you say, well, McCain, some of you said McCain has to do this in order to appeal to the center. I heard the same rubbish when Bush was running. I heard the same voices of compromise calling this show then, saying, well, President Bush has to appeal to the center in order to win. Well, you see, once you start appealing to the center and to the left, you then start to compromise by literally becoming like the center and the left, and you lose your core audience, which is exactly what happened with Bush, and it's exactly what's happening with McCain. McCain has not excited the core base that could elect him. He has not done so, and I'm not sure McCain can win at all. He may think that by sitting on the sidelines and letting the Democrats attack each other, he's going to win. He's wrong. If he has not learned, and the bartender who runs his campaign has not learned anything from Pennsylvania, then he's a doomed man. He will go back to Arizona, where he will probably lose his Senate seat because he's not even beloved in his own state because of his desire to grant amnesty to illegal aliens. And, you know, I've listened to McCain on this immigration issue several times now over the last month. And if you read very carefully what he says, he hasn't repudiated his amnesty for illegals plan. He's gone right back to it. He said, well, first we have to secure the borders, and then we have to grant a temporary worker status to the illegal alien. He's doing exactly the same thing that is in the Kennedy, McCain-Kennedy bill. Exactly the same thing. Now, you could argue that it's okay to grant amnesty to 25 million illegal aliens and let them bring in five relatives each, so that there's 125 million illegal aliens in America virtually overnight, and that you lose the country, you become another nation demographically. If that's what you want and you always wanted to live in Tijuana, I can't argue with you. If you always dreamed of moving to Mexico, but you were too lazy to do so, this is the way to do it, because this way Mexico can move to you. You know that or not? What do you want to talk about? Chicago. Ken, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, I want to see more fire in the belly from John McCain. You know, he should be beating up Hillary and Barack Obama. And I know there's a civility to politics, and I think at the end of the day, John McCain, you know, will ultimately have to work with these people in the Senate and the Congress. But, you know, if you want to win, that's what you're going to have to do. You got to get down in the mud and roll.
Well, that's what Hillary – isn't that how Hillary beat Obama? Didn't she dig up two of the worst things she could find about Obama, the preacher, that worked real good, that knocked her ahead, that moved her ahead from a running behind to running ahead. And then, of course, when Obama was secretly recorded in San Francisco with the thing about the guns and the religion, that was the final nail in his coffin. And she won by 10 points. She won not by being nice, not by compromising, not by saying these sound bites have no place in my campaign. She played it perfectly. She didn't talk about them, but she made sure they were dug up and played. And McCain apparently doesn't even learn from Pennsylvania. He doesn't have fire in the belly. He has fire in the jelly, I think.
Yeah. Mike, one other thing I'd like to say in regards to the guns and the religion comment, I mean, Obama, that just shows how out of contact he is with the American public, because guns and religion in America are part of our culture. If you
Correct.
Don't know that, as an elected official,
right,
then you don't deserve to be running this country.
No, absolutely not. He's a far-left internationalist who would like to see America disappear as a nation and be folded into a new world order on an express train, whereas Bush has been pushing it on a fairly moderate basis, the internationalism. Look, you know, the prognosis from old Doc Savage is not very good. This country is being moved towards a new world order on a very rapid basis, and John McCain himself even repudiated that. He said the other day, well, when I hear people using the word globalism and globalist, they don't even know what they're talking about. McCain said he's in favor of keeping NAFTA right in front of a factory that's been boarded up. And the Democrats are saying we will revisit NAFTA. We may revise NAFTA. We may stop NAFTA because of what it's done to the landscape of American manufacturing. It seems to me they're in better touch with the average worker than McCain is.
Definitely. I would definitely like to see that. I'd like to see some tougher restriction when it comes to global trade. I mean, you know, countries have been trading with each other since, you know, they were trading with spices and precious metals. I mean, you know, it's a necessity of civilization.
Correct. Right. We're not suggesting that we become isolationist. However, there is no playing field. Ken, listen to me and everyone else. I know an awful lot more about this than I'm willing to discuss. But if you own a small business in America that has a manufacturing business that makes a product, and you try to get that product across the border into Mexico, I would like to show you the kind of paperwork you have to fill out and the many hurdles you have to overcome in order to get that product into Mexico. The politicians like George Bush are bald, naked liars when they tell you that NAFTA has been good for American business. It's been very good for a few gigantic billionaire businessmen. But that's not the same as being good for American business. Most American businesses have been devastated by this free trade with Mexico. It's not free trade. How do you explain the fact that we used to export products to Mexico, and right now Mexico is exporting more products to our country than we're exporting to theirs? Doesn't the man understand we have a currency crisis, a trade imbalance? These are the real issues of the day today, Ken.
Yes, I understand and agree with you 100%.
But John McCain came out the other day in Ohio and said that it's not the time to revise NAFTA. It's been good for America. He's standing in front of a boarded up factory, and he says to out of work factory workers that NAFTA has been good for the American worker. So if McCain is not just a party hack for the existent Republican establishment, I don't know who is. He is the standard bearer of the old guard Republican hacks. That's who he is. Make no mistake about it. And I'm sick and tired of hearing about Vietnam. I've given him credit for that. I salute him for that. I respect him for that. That's not enough to launch him into the White House, Ken.
I agree.
Thanks for the call. That's it. Maybe we should have some music right now. Play Bollywood Indian music, because I'm going to tell you something that I read this morning that you're not going to like to hear. If you think... This brings back so many memories to me. What she's singing is, sister has Mercedes, she married techie. Why no Mercedes? Why you only poor man? Sister has Mercedes, I have no Mercedes. That's a rough translation. Why no Mercedes? I as good as sister. Her husband better than you. He bought her Mercedes. No Mercedes for me. Why? You no man. I don't know if that's an exact translation. My Hindi, I haven't brushed up on my Hindi recently. I used to love this music. The years I was in Fiji, in between collecting plants, I listened. Now the man sings, I tried to buy you car. Most I could afford is Buick. Opal Buick. No Mercedes for you. I'm only poor man. Maybe tomorrow, Mercedes. Okay, you get the picture. The jokes aside, and I hope that the folks who listen to the show of Indian descent are not going to get angry, but I can't be sure of that. The reason we're playing this music is simple. Picked up the paper this morning and found out that debt collectors who speak to you in perfect English, American accents, are actually calling you from Gurugram, India. There are hundreds and hundreds of people on the telephone calling Americans who are out of work, who are forgetful and debt-stricken and demanding cash from them. And they're not even Americans. They are in India. Some of our distinguished businessmen in America have decided to not pay the going rate for wages in America. They've outsourced even a job as menial as debt collection to India. And when I read this story, I wasn't angry at India. I was furious at my politicians. I was furious that they would let even a job such as this go to India, that they wouldn't even stop this. And they named the companies, and they told us how much they make. They told us how much the debt collectors make here as opposed to how much they make there. And I said, if this keeps up, there'll be no jobs in this country at all within 10 years. There'll be none whatsoever. The fact of the matter is, it says debt collectors in the United States make about $6,500 a month. I guess that works out to somewhere near $90,000 a year, or what, $78,000 a year. It says in India, though, the average salary is $425 a month. So let me see if I understand this. If the businesses in America are permitted to outsource virtually any job and every job that they want, and outsource the manufacturing of any and all products to the lowest and cheapest common denominator, what will that leave in America? Well, certainly there will still be in America, but the people will be earning $425 a month, and we'll be living as though we are in the third world. So what the greed, what greed is producing in this country, and the spinelessness and corruption of our Congress is producing, is the devolution of this nation from a first world nation already into a third world nation in areas like New York City, San Francisco, and Los Angeles, particularly in the immigrant communities. But overall, if you add it all up, this country is rapidly descending to a second world status. And the only thing that distinguishes us, there are a few things that do. One is our great military. The other thing is our healthcare system, which has not yet been totally, let's say, victimized by these forces. So, again, to get back to it, if they're going to outsource even debt collecting because it's cheaper to have somebody in India calling a poor person here who hasn't paid their bill, tell me where this ends and how it ends, and tell me if we should not stop outsourcing jobs. Of course it has to be stopped. How can it be stopped, though, if we have politicians who can be bought for less money than you can buy a prostitute in Moscow? Now play the Bollywood music for a few seconds. Give them a break, and I'll be right back. Mercedes. Sister has big Mercedes. E320. I have little Opal. I pretty like sister. I want E322. Bigger Mercedes than sister too.
Take a break.
Savage. This is really going to kill the ads for curry paste on my show, I can tell you that. There goes all the revenue from the curry paste ads. Curry paste revenue is right out the window. I admire the Indian people, and they're smart enough to know that. They've listened over the years. They know that. But we're talking about the outsourcing, and it's not about India. It's about our political system that permits this. What sane nation permits jobs and manufacturing to bleed out of its own country? What sane nation permits the poorest of the poor of illiterates to flood into a country while the jobs are allowed to bleed out of a country? Tell me what country survives. Just follow the game out. You don't even have to play chess to know how it ends. All you have to do is play backgammon or checkers to understand how this game ends. Unless we get some new leadership, this country will be out of business. 15 years of Clinton and Bush, and this country is bankrupt. Look at the trade imbalance. Look at the value of the dollar. Take a look at the oil problems we're having now. This is an example of a healthy nation. And these are only the tip of the iceberg. What about the moral imperative in this country? There was once such a big thing to launch George Bush into power. Whatever happened to the war against immorality? Whatever happened to family values? Where did that go out the window? No longer worked for the Republicans, so they dropped it like a hot potato. They're not interested anymore in the culture wars because it wasn't selling. And you would say, well, okay, it didn't sell very well in San Francisco, so they had to drop it. They had to compromise with any Twosome Newsome's crowd. Nancy Pelosi's crowd, where they invent scripture every day. Nancy Pelosi invents scripture on a daily basis and to try to sell left-wing wackoism. So I've said my piece. I mean, Mexican official caught stealing White House BlackBerry devices. Did you hear that? During George Bush's Three Amigos meeting the other day in New Orleans, apparently there had been a meeting in the White House, and one of the so-called Mexican officials, whose first name is Rafael, took 6 or 7 blackberries from a table outside a special room in the hotel where the Mexican delegation was meeting with President Bush. You hear this? And they all come here to work. Even the diplomats. Even the diplomats stole blackberries and were supposed to sit here and not notice what goes on. Oh, yeah, it's just so great. I mean, if you want to, you know, this is something that only a cartoonist in the age of the original Punch magazine in England could understand how to do a cartoon on this. They would show some pompous, bloated Tory leader in England meeting with someone from South America, let us say in the House of Commons, or let's say in a fancy hotel in London. And while he's sitting up there bloatedly talking about the wonders of trade with this nation and whatnot, there'd be a fellow behind him with a long handlebar mustache and pointy fingers with fingernails stealing blackberries out of the bloated politician's pocket. And the English people would have gotten a kick out of it in Pickwickian times, wouldn't they? But of course, we don't live in Pickwickian times. We live in Stickwickian times right now, where it's propaganda day and night, one after another, one statement after another. Everything has been, it's worse than creamed corn. This is worse. What passes for the news today is more tasteless than out-of-date creamed corn that you wouldn't even give away to an earthquake victim in Indonesia after a tsunami. KNEW, Will, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Hey, Mike, I just wanted to point out as far as an outsourcing job in India. My fiance, she just moved here from India. She's been here for 3 years. One of the things she told me scared me. She told me that all the paperwork processing for the IRS is in Bombay, India.
My God, the government is out. Maybe we could outsource the presidency and have a virtual president talk to us from Bangalore. That might be. We might get a better president there. They're more intelligent, probably more trustworthy than our politicians. There's an idea. Play the Bollywood music as I ponder that idea. Mercedes. We're going to go out with a little tune now. I want E320. Oh, no, no. Sister not as pretty as E320. I want 430. You get me Mercedes for 30. Oh, you know, get Kama Sutra tonight.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Yet I don't even know if I'm on yet. Yeah, maybe you'll wake up one day and somebody in India will have offed my voice and the show will be coming to you from Bangalore. This is the Savage Nation. After all, I mean, the bottom line is the bottom line. It's all about bucks, isn't it? You gotta have a laugh once in a while. I don't think there's too much of a sense of humor left in America, but I still have it. If you don't, it's your loss. All right, turn her off. I'll do it again later when I'm in the mood. I thought it was one of the best moments of radio that I've had in years. But I think it went over like it missed. I don't know. People don't get everything that I do. That was funny. Some things are funny. Some things are not. That's funny. But it's cultural. You have to understand me in order to understand that I do. Now, we're talking about politicians. And we have idiots like Arnold Schwarzenegger, for example. Here is a man whose brain was cooked a long time ago by the Kleeglites of Hollywood. He's always been a phony. A muscle man with a brain cooked like a strudel. Listen to clip 26.
You have to understand that they know the reality. I think they just try to protect business. And in the end, they're hurting business. Because we've proven in California that you can do both.
Right.
That you can protect the environment and protect business. Even though in 2003 when I ran and I said that, people didn't believe it. But then when we started building the hydrogen highway and passed the Green Building Initiative.
I can't even let you turn them off. He's saying that anyone who denies global warming is protecting business. I guess that would be the thousands of scientists who have no connection to business. But this is just politics, as usual. When you can have a sellout knish like Newt Gingrich selling himself like a prostitute to Al Gore for a few dollars, you know, for a few pieces of silver. I mean, they're all getting in on the money, that's all. And I have probably done more for protecting the actual environment than all the politicians who are talking about global warming put together. Remember, my father wasn't a senator who then became the president of Occidental Coal. So don't tell me that I don't know what I'm talking about. The big story of the day really is the Obama ad that features Obama's hateful racist pastor, Jeremiah Wright. And the ad was run in North Carolina, and John McCain, the shoe salesman, instead of attacking the racist preacher, attacks the Republican Party for using the ad. Listen to clip two.
There's no place in the Republican Party for the kind of ad that was put up by the North Carolina Republican Party.
Now, let's stop right there. John, you're wrong. You should say there's no place in America for the kind of rhetoric that came out of Barack Obama's preacher's mouth. That's what you should have said. But you're not being advised properly. You're a compromised man. You're just like most of the men in the corporate world that may know better, but know that they're, well, let's just say they may know better, but they can't say better. That's all there is to it. John, W-O-R, go ahead, please.
Yeah, McCain has class, all right? And that's a sign of it. All these politicians knocking each other, they're just like the Jerry Springer show.
So you don't think it's important to discuss Jeremiah Wright and what he says and what that may mean for America should Obama become president?
Yeah, first of all, it's already been done. He's got class. He's the one with the killer instinct who knows how to fight.
Wait, you're going off the mark here. I'm asking you another question, though. You think that that topic has been totally discussed and adequately when, in fact, it's Obama's people who try to sweep it away from sweep it under the rug? Teddy, stop it.
I'm saying to you that the guy is the only one running. Hillary is disgusting with that thick smile, constantly slinging dirt, acting like she's not slinging dirt. This guy is constantly Obama saying things.
All right, so what is going to happen? You're into class. I accept that. So what's going to happen when it comes down to McCain versus one of the two of them and they sling mud at him? What are you going to say then?
Look, all I'm saying is he's a fighter pilot. He knows when to attack.
I know about the fact that he's a fighter pilot. We give him credit for that. I understand all of the gentleman and a warrior thing. But that may not be enough for him to become president. Some very distinguished military men have turned out to be horrendous politicians. Need I remind you of a general who was fundamentally a mouthpiece for Hillary Clinton, who has not been heard from, by the way, recently? He himself ran for the presidency last time. He tried to run up a trial balloon. Do you remember his name?
Yes, Clark. I agree with you.
All right. Well, okay. Yeah, I don't think you and I are arguing over McCain's class. We understand that. But what I'm saying is politics requires getting down and dirty sometimes. Don't you think that McCain's going to have to get a little tougher once they start throwing mud at him?
Because these people are so transparent, and more is going to come out that he'll just walk right through it. Unscathed, like a fire getting hit low, it'll eventually just be stopped by the referee. The public will just be like, Hillary's one lie just leads to a bigger lie. Obama, one thing leads to another lie. I mean, it's going to get more worse for the Democrats.
Well, I don't know that you're right. I hear where you're coming from. I didn't see it that way, and I still don't, but I could see where you might. And I thank you for calling. There's no need for me to argue with everyone who calls the show. Play the Bollywood music again. I think I'll go back to jokes. Bad humor. Or I'll just get the dog to bark in the radio studio and talk about dogs. I used to love this music. Those rainy days in Fiji, waiting between plant collecting trips and the Land Rover, the mud. Smell of the formaldehyde in the herbarium. wonder what President Bush has to say about the outsourcing of jobs to India.
The United States is looking forward to eating Indian mangoes.
All right. Well, the United States is looking forward to tiger skins from rare tigers in India, too, I guess. If that'll bring a few dollars into the coffers of the Republican Party, why not bring in the endangered animal skins and say that's good for the economy, too? Crazy. The whole thing's nuts. Let's see what else is in the news here. Los Angeles, a third world city. I'm not shocked by that report. Of course, one third of immigrants have not graduated from high school, and 60% do not speak English fluently. No kidding. I'm shocked. Well, I guess that means we're a racist nation because we don't speak their language. See, if we weren't a racist nation, we would become illiterate and we wouldn't speak English anymore to make them feel comfortable. That's the implication of the article, is that if us Anglos were not really racist in our heart, we would cease speaking English and we would, I guess we wouldn't even be citizens anymore. We'd give up our citizenship to... I went to the Motor Vehicle Bureau again today. Oh, my God, what a mess. God, turbans, burkas. It's unbelievable what goes on in there. Let's see. Debunking global warming. Forget global warming. Prepare for the new ice age. Grizzly bear. Trainer says bear loving and safe. That's even though he killed a guy. He's loving and safe. Wife charged in kinky husband's bondage death. I won't read that article. It's boring. Robot vigilante targets Atlanta vagrants? What's that about? Teen busted for assault for running wheelchair over classmate's toe? Eh. What I really wanted on my website, but I'm having trouble communicating, is the article about McCain that is exciting the audience today, where I said to you, McCain, I don't even know where the article went already, but it should be on the top right of michaelsavage.com. It probably will be by the end of the program. I can't even talk about the polygamy case. It's too heartbreaking. But when I see somebody as psychotic, in my opinion, as Nancy Grace, doing to these children and to these mothers with viciousness what she is doing on that CNN, my blood boils to see a woman making a living with the hatred that she, the invective and the hatred for these polygamy people. Now, let me ask you something. What if the government passed a law that said the children of television broadcasters whose stock and trade is playing upon rapes and murders and bloodlust are being subjected to child abuse, and those children should be taken away from the parents? In other words, any mother in the media, in other words, any media personality who has children, and that media personality specializes in stories about rape, molestation, and bloodlust, and does it day and night, that child is being subjected to child abuse in the interests of the state. We're going to take away the children from that kind of female broadcaster, and they send in an armored personnel carrier, men with machine guns and body armor, and they forcibly remove the babies from such a television broadcaster. You would say, that's crazy. It can't happen here. Well, why would such a television broadcaster be salivating over the seizure of children from a ranch in Texas? Doesn't she understand that she could have it happen to her if she keeps this up? Well, the answer is she doesn't understand that. That's why she's in the business she's in. That's why if you look at her eyes, you see the eyes that you would find in a textbook on psychopathology. In other words, in my opinion, if you go into a standard psychology text, a psychiatry textbook of another time when they actually showed the eyes of madness, they used to have pictures in psychiatric textbooks. I used to read these. But there was a time that I used to read medical textbooks sometimes just for the pictures when I was younger. I would read some surgery textbooks. They were amazing. We used to do it as a hobby when I was in school for entertainment. People have a curious mind. Maybe it's a macabre sense of humor. I don't really know what it is. Doesn't really matter. And minds will go many different places. But if you looked in psychiatric textbooks of a certain number of decades ago, they would show the faces of madness in the back wards of mental hospitals. And I swear to you that if you took the eyes off those patients and you pasted them on your TV screen at night, you would see the faces of those in the media today. I'll be right back. I'm in the mood to take the show in a totally different direction right now. You know, it's late April already. It's almost approaching summertime. You can feel it in the air out here on the West Coast. We've had a cold wave. Now it's going to be hot. We have a high pressure coming in. And if I were a normal person, I'd be looking forward to a summer vacation. I don't take these vacations. I really should maybe get back into the rhythm of life again. It's radio, radio, radio. It becomes a total obsession. But it's nice out there. I mean, aside from all this political rubbish, there's a world at large. And I do take pleasure in watching my apricots, you know, come to fruit. It's an amazing thing to watch fruit grow. I know it sounds like, well, what are you talking about? Where'd you come from? It's very stabilizing. I planted these fruit trees 5 years ago. On one property I have, a little place up on a hill, I have 20-year-old apricot trees and nectarine trees. This is something unbelievable when the bumper crop comes up. But in another place, I have a smaller place, I planted a cherry tree, a pear tree, and apricots, which I love. And they've never really borne very much, you know, for some reason. But this year, it's already, what, in April? You could see the fruits all over this apricot tree, and it's going to be a bumper crop. There's something very satisfying in watching a fruit grow on a tree. I know you say, what, are you crazy? You're getting old. I don't know. There's something fundamental about it. Houston, Texas, AJ, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Thank you. It's an honor to speak to you, Dr. Savage. I've been
thank you.
Long-time fan of yours. I've been listening to you for about 3 years, and I love the Bollywood music you just played earlier. And
are you of Indian heritage, AJ?
Yes, I am. I was born and raised in India. I've been here for 25 years.
So you knew that I was doing this in good taste and it was not meant to debase the Indian people. And that's why I like the Indian people. They're clever clever enough to understand humor.
Yes, we are. And we love you. I've got a whole bunch of Indians rooting for you. They listen to your show every day.
You know why? Why do I love the Indian people? Because they're amongst the brightest of all people on the planet. How do you explain, as I've said many times, the Indian people come here, and within a few years, the children are winning spelling bees. How is that possible? Others come here for generations, and all they do is bellyache and tell you that it's a racist nation. I mean, the Indians are basically dark-skinned people, but they seem to move ahead. Somehow it doesn't seem to be a racist nation for Indians. How is that possible?
I don't know, but...
I do know because you have a heritage where learning is respected. You have a heritage with an integrated family system. The families stay together. The communities stay together. Instead of killing each other, they help each other. Instead of telling your children to hate the country, they tell the children to study hard and move ahead in the country. That's why your children are so smart.
Yeah, I just want to let you know that my 7-year-old son knows your number to call, and he's tried even a couple of times himself.
But getting back to my joke about the outsourcing and the Bollywood music where I make believe the girl is saying, I want Mercedes, that is very funny in its own way. And you have to understand the Indian culture to understand that really is funny. Isn't that really basically what's going on?
Yes, it is, and it's actually the music.
It is. It really is. I mean, you know, look, you got to understand the immigrant cultures of various societies to understand that it's only meant in good taste. Anyway, AJ, you're a good sport. I'm going to send you a Savage Nation cap made in a slave labor camp in China. I'm joking. It's made in America, AJ. Stay in the line. You know, I have these caps and cups. They're made in America. They cost me about triple what I get. The guy who makes them says, don't you want it made in China? They'd be one-third the cost. I said, can't do it. I hope they're still made in America. I think they are. They're still made. Somebody can still make a hat somewhere in America. I think the cups are even made here. They're not out of toxic China. You know, God knows. Here's a story from my website that I found. I changed the headline. The archives of the Bay Area rock band The Grateful Dead, blah, 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 memorabilia, blah, 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 is going to be given to the University of California, Santa Cruz. So my headline is a little different than the one of the local rag, and I wrote, Junkies garbage to be housed at University of California. I mean, what are they celebrating here? What exactly is there to celebrate about the Grateful Dead? Play the music. You know what this is about? Getting high on cocaine in the main vein or main.
Driving that train, high on cocaine. Casey Jones, you better watch your speed. Trouble ahead.
All right, so that's what the University of California at Santa Cruz considers to be a real score, is 30 years of junkies memorabilia. I wonder if they're going to get any used needles. Includes the band's first recording contract, life-size skeletons of band members. Why don't they just disinter the dead band members and put, you know, cover the, you know, clean the skeletons up and coat them in some kind of varnish, and they could just hang them there at the University of California, Santa Cruz. An artwork handmade by its fans ahead at the UC Santa Cruz, where they will be displayed at McHenry Library. To me, this is a symptom of the downfall of civilization. Why would they put this in a university? I could see it being put in a rock and roll museum where this kind of stuff belongs. But why would you put this memorabilia in a university? I don't have any answer to this question.
Savage.
We're not in a recession. We're in a slowdown. We grew in the fourth quarter last year. We haven't had first quarter growth statistics yet, but there's no question we're in a slowdown.
It's not a recession. Well, it depends upon who you're talking to. The crooks on Wall Street is certainly not a recession. Three of them made over $3 billion last year. Of course, there's no recession on Wall Street. One of the crooks bought a house for $82 million in West Palm Beach. There's no recession for him. And I suppose the people who get to visit the White House, they tell them there's no recession. We never had it so good. But tell that to the people in Youngstown, Ohio. See what they have to say. Ford swings to $100 million profit in first quarter, predicts full year loss, but says it will make money in 09. Duh. What? Surprise profit of $100 million. They're manipulating the books is what it is. They got a clever guy in there who knows how to like swing things around. But they're making money overseas and losing money here. Strong profits for Ford in Europe and South America. But really, they're not making any money here because of the high cost of manufacturing wages, in other words. So you could say, oh, blame the unions. Well, what do you want people to live on? I never understood this Republican nonsense that unions have no right to lobby for the worker. See, I've worked in factories. They haven't. Most of these people were born with cherry vanilla ice cream spoons in their mouth. I've worked in factories, and I've spoken to people who were actually working as truck drivers pre-union, if you can believe it. I've spoken with people who worked as truck drivers before there was an AFL-CIO. I understand the corruption. We all know that. And they know it, too. But they said overall the union did more for them than the negatives. That's what truck drivers will tell you, the union truck drivers that I spoke to. They had pensions, they had health care plans, they made a minimum wage they could live on. Before that, they were dirt poor. Now, what do you want workers in America to do? Start living like in China? You want them to eat one cup of rice a day, if they can afford that? Would that make you Republican big business types happy? I am not a Republican. I'm an independent. I've told you that from the beginning. I'm not changing my stripes to suit the new audience. I don't know who the audience is. I haven't any idea who it is. I know there's an audience of a certain gross number of people, but I've been the same way from the day I began. I come from a different background. So very often people who criticize me don't even listen to the show. They just say, oh, he's like Rush Limbaugh. Well, I wouldn't mind that as a comparison. Rush does a very good job, but I'm not like him at all. He does his thing. I do my thing. We have different backgrounds. I have worked in factories. I don't know whether he has. I've been a caddy, not a golfer. I've worked in a factory, and now I may own one somewhere at some place. I don't know. So I've been, you know, up and down the scale of American life. But if you can walk with kings and never lose the common touch, then you'll be a man, my son. The trick is to never forget your roots, never. Because the day you forget your roots, you're finished. Then what are you? I don't know. What are you? What do you become? So I don't mean to be too preachy. I do that on a regular basis, but I'm not in the mood to do it right now. What I'm going to do right now is open the show up to requests, 1-800-449-8255. That's the request line. Whatever you want, it's late spring already. If I were a normal person, I'd be looking forward to getting out of school, meaning if I was still 8 years old. But inside me, there's still a 10-year-old kid who can't wait for the summer to roll around. There's nowhere to go, though. Kids do know what to do with summer vacations, at least they used to. We play cowboys and Indians in the woods all summer. We didn't go to learning camps. Nobody in my generation, like, we didn't have the money for that. So we didn't go to, like, piano camp or baseball camp or fat kids camp. There were kids who could play the piano. There were kids who could play baseball, but they didn't go to special camps for it. We all went to a little place together as the families moved up from the tenements as a group and rented little cottages in a place called a bungalow colony. And We hung out for 10 of the greatest weeks of the year. Oh, they were so nice. We played in the woods. We had, you know, picnics and barbecues. We scared each other at night walking on dark roads to the one candy store that was about a mile and a half away through the woods with no lights on the road. Those were great nights. Kids would scare each other with sounds, you know, what you hear in the woods. It was like out of it. I think of it now, how innocent it really was. It's as though I grew up in a time when Tom Sawyer were alive, and believe me, I didn't. But it seems like another universe, just another age, another time. There were not even television sets in that particular that cottage, that set of cottages. There were no TV set. That's where I met Woodchuck Bill. I've told you about Woodchuck Bill. I don't want to reiterate the story. It's going to be in my autobiography and in the movie. But Woodchuck Bill is a great story. But I will take, I'll take requests. Those of you who are regulars, who are in the theater right now, inside the big tent of the Savage Nation, what would you like me to do for your entertainment right now? Because this is the this is the segment I like the most. If there's no requests, okay, that's fine. I could do the Middle East. I could do the Midwest. I could do the Far West. I could do the Far East. I could do the Grateful Undead. And what kind of university would take the memorabilia of a junkie's closet and turn it? I don't understand this. How could they do that? That is a good story. But what's the point of talking about it? That's the University of California today. They take the memorabilia of a junkie band and turn it into a museum piece. That's it. That's the world. That's the world that I've inherited. That's not the world I chose to be in. But I'm an adaptable creature. I can live in any world. You know, if you give me a limousine, I know how to ride. And why don't you put me on a donkey? I can ride a donkey too. And that's the beauty. You know what I mean? You got to remain able to ride on a donkey and able to sit in the back of a limo. I think I prefer a donkey to a limo, by the way. I don't even like limousines. You ever notice how uncomfortable the limousines are? The seats are horrible. Even the limousines are uncomfortable today. They're for children in high school to stick their heads out and flash people as they go by. What's the value of a limousine? I mean, what do you need it for today? The seats are horribly uncomfortable. They have that big U-shaped seat, and the back seat is hard as a rock. Limousines should have like a soft fabric seat. Anyway, let's not start talking about that. I think I may go cold turkey right now. I've got callers, but I'm not in the mood for any of the topics I excited you about. I think I may do something that's never done in radio, which is take a full board of callers, all the lights are lit, and say, clean them off and give me a blank board, because maybe I want to put myself on the tightrope right now and start to walk the line on the Savage Nation, and I'll see where I wind up. Don't do it. Don't you dare do that. I'll kill you if you do that. Marilyn, Betty, you're on the Savage Nation. What's on your mind?
Yes, I just want to let you know, Michael, and your listeners, that Mahmoud Abbas is not a man of peace in regard to what President George Bush said about him.
All right, so you know Abbas's past when he was not exactly a man of peace, but to be fair to the discussion, many national leaders were once terrorists, and then they put on a suit and tie and they become statesmen. You know, the statesman of today is often the terrorist of yesterday.
Yes, that's true. But
and I'm not trying to apologize for terrorism. Don't get me wrong. But if you look at the founding of Israel, some of the early leaders were pretty good revolutionary fighters. By the way, Betty, they were pretty good revolutionary fighters. And I studied the early days of Israel, and not only what they had to do to make a nation. But what they did to each other was amazing. Do you know what Begin had to do to what? Not what he had. Do you know what Begin, one of the early leaders of Israel, did to the opposition leader amongst the early revolutionaries when they caught him? I'm talking Jew to Jew. He took him and they put his fingers in a door jam, and they slammed the door shut on his fingers. Do you know that?
No, I didn't know that.
Well, no, you know, these are uncomfortable facts. You know, my problem is I read a lot. And I have a historical basis. So, yeah, Abbas is not a man of peace in terms of what he did originally working with Fatah. We understand that. But maybe he's come to understand that he has to become a little more diplomatic in order to build a nation. I don't have an answer for this, Betty. This is definitely not going to resolve in my lifetime. The Jews and the Palestinians, or the Arabs and the Jews in that regard, have been killing each other since biblical times. You know, I don't have an answer for it. I don't have a messianic complex, as does George Bush, who thinks he can reverse history here. I don't think there's an answer to this. Thanks for the call. I know I made a lot of friends just now. building friends one day at a time on this on the Savage Nation. Wesley Snipes hit with the tax thing, 3.5 years. They threw the book at him. What do you expect? What did he expect if you tax dodge? One thing you got to be careful. You just better pay every dime you complain. Look, it's legal to complain about it all you want. Keep complaining. That's okay. We don't mind. Free country. Just make sure you send it in on time. Snipes gets maximum sentence 36 months in prison. Ooh. I got some friends out there in jail trying to, like, get him a low ball. I mean, a low Woody Harrelson. That's some character witness. Snipes had many character witness letters written by friends, including Woody Harrelson. Yeah, that's great. Why don't they just go to Charles Manson and have him write a letter saying that Wesley Snipes is a good friend of mine, and I recommend that you give him a lighter sentence. That's good. Woody Harrelson, a great, great character. Indiana, Eric, you're on the Savage Nation. What's on your mind, sir?
Dr. Savage, I've been listening to your show since the beginning of the Gulf War, Gulf War Part Two. And one thing I'm really interested in is how you made it in graduate school. I'm a graduate school student myself, and how did you push yourself through those times of academic trial by fire, if you will?
Wow. You know, Eric, I earned a real PhD as opposed to a fake one from one of the great universities. It was great then, and it still is great in the sciences. It was the hardest 3 years of my entire life. Was earning my PhD. I look back upon it. They were the hardest years of my life, Eric. I got to tell you, the real McCoy graduate school is really a trial by fire. You know that, don't you?
Yes, exactly.
And you have to be prepared to really go through some hazing to get your degree. What are you getting your degree in? Is it a master's or a PhD, and in what field?
Master's degree in English as a second language.
Well, any level of graduate school, if it's a legitimate degree, is it a thesis program or a non-thesis program?
For now.
All right. Well, you know what to expect. I don't want to indulge people in my particular past, but I'll give you a little anecdote. I could remember to this day the final oral examination. Well, it wasn't the final, to be honest with you. It went back early. You know that I earned my PhD in 3 years? Which may be a world record from the University of California at Berkeley, and it wasn't given to me. I earned it in 3 years, which actually I look back upon. It's it's a pretty big accomplishment. I never talk about it because people will assume that turns me into some kind of elitist, and perhaps I am in some way. I don't deny it, but I shouldn't apologize for having achieved it. I'm very proud of it. I don't talk about it much, but I did it in 3 years, which I don't know if that's a world record. I don't know how much faster you can earn a doctorate with a written dissertation than in 3 years, but I did it. I remember when I entered the program, I had to go through the dean of the graduate school. He had to decide whether it was thumbs up or thumbs down, and he did an interview. And he was a small man with a very high-pitched voice, almost like a woman. And I could remember to this day sitting in his office and listening to the clock tick. I could hear the hands clicking by the second. Each second felt like at least 20, 30 minutes to me. Because although he would ask a question that seemed rather innocent and benign, and he would do it with his fingers stenciled, or in a little pyramid, and with a smile as though he were your friend, but he was truly being an interrogator as to whether or not you were qualified to enter this very, very difficult road called an independent PhD program, because they didn't just let you do it. You had to show that you were better than the average person who was going to go into a department and get a degree in a department. I was doing it across 3 or 4 departments at once. He asked me some questions. I can't remember the questions, but I remember the tension of that particular meeting. Now, I'm going to tell you a funny story. I don't know if I should, but I will. I remember the tension was so great that day that after that particular discussion, and you don't know the results, I didn't know what the dean was going to do until days later. It's like a trial, as I said. You know, he says, oh, well, thank you very much for coming in. Look forward to hearing from me, and then you leave. Well, I walked out of there so drained. And I'm going to try to describe it. I went into the men's room to recover, and I sat down where men sit in a restroom, and I felt as though my entire being had disappeared. Maybe it was a semi-psychotic reaction. I don't really know. The stress was so great. Has anyone ever had that kind of experience where I sat down in the stall, and I felt my body disappear as though I wasn't there? Now, I understood, you know, months later what that signified psychologically. What it signified was that I was basically reduced to nothing by that intake interview by that dean. That's what it came down to. And it's part of the hazing of graduate school. Believe me, it's not easy. And I overcame it. It took me years. But remember, I had two young children at the time. I was working a full-time job at the time. I was writing books at the time to get myself through graduate school, and I was working for a PhD. So I have a tremendous work ethic and a lot of drive in me. Unfortunately, when I got out, I didn't have a teaching a position waiting because the basic field that I was in was extremely experimental and way ahead of its time. But more than that, they were not hiring white males. They were interested in hiring anyone except the white male. And so those were the hardest years of my life. It wasn't getting the degree. It was getting after the degree when the professors had said, oh, get your PhD. It's a union card. So what do you mean a union card? Well, you get a PhD, you're automatically going to get a professorship. Well, that was true for those guys. But what they did was they didn't want competition. A lot of the men who encouraged me to go get my degree basically stood in my way from becoming a professor because they wanted dummies working for them so they can get away with murder. They didn't want bright guys like me biting at their heels trying to take their position. So they hired dummies. And consequently, universities and most departments, particularly the social sciences, are what they have become today. And what some of these professors did was pretty astonishing. Instead of retiring at age 70, as was the rule, because they didn't have men like me to stop them, they rewrote the rules which said that they could stay on after 70 as quote-unquote consultants at full pay. So many of them worked till they were 80, 85 as total incompetent dodo birds sitting in those professor chairs, and the people they let into the universities were not smart enough to see what they were doing. I'll be right back.
Savage.
We're playing Italian music because I have a treat for you. I found the poem When Pasta Was Spaghetti in my archives. It was written, let's see, Michael Savage, August 1985, written in a lightning storm at 40,000 feet over Cheyenne, Wyoming, when I thought the plane was going to crash. I wrote When Pasta Was Spaghetti. So here it is, whether you like it or not, all right? So you liberals get ready to sneer, and you sane people get ready to enjoy it because it's a wonderful poem. So play the music again. Go ahead. They got the mood. We got the mood set up. It's called When Pasta Was Spaghetti, and try to imagine it, all right? The hairy forearms of New York serve you your coffee with a turning gesture, an offering that says drink, eat, enjoy. The wiry Italian in Vincent's clam bar, the one behind the greased over register, the young kid connected who receives his deference from the spaghetti cook older than his gangster father, the spaghetti cook who looks like an old-fashioned doctor from the Bronx with clipped mustache. He actually pulls some noodles out of the pot and eats them as they cook, looking to the grimy ceiling for his tender answer. Well, they used to call it spaghetti. Now it's pasta at $10 a plate. The smoky windows of Romeo's Spaghetti now offers radios and knickknacks. It was 50 cents a plate then. In neon letters that you couldn't miss, even through a fogged over window on a cold winter's eve, there was life. Marinara sauce that smacked to the sea. Noodles as long as your young arm. Meatballs as fluffy as your dream of them. Bread on the table you'd eat against your parents' admonitions that the meal was coming, the meal was coming. And men, some burly with black hairy forearms whose smile scared you, and little skinny guys with the look of murder on their faces, and people who slurped their spaghetti straight to their mouths from the plate, one motion like Chinese shoveling rice at mouth with clicking sticks. That was gusto before it became a beer ad. That was taste before it became a synonym for fashion. That was spaghetti before it became pasta. Play the music, basta. Very good. I'll do that for private readings for $100,000 for my favorite charity, which is the Poor Revere Society. You want me at your party? You want me at your party? I'll come and read Pasta with Spaghetti. What if I actually had a gangster call me up? Like, all right, Mike, we want you to read that pasta with spaghetti. I'll give you $100,000, nothing to us. I would do it. I would do it for $10,000, let's say. I read that Chicken Behind gets $1 million per private performance. Could you believe this? The guy started as a street mime in San Francisco. $1 million, they say, he gets for personal performance at someone's party. Unbelievable. I mean, there is a price at which you'll be a clown. That's all. That got me through my 18th year when I thought I was too good for anything. You ever go through that? That's how a lot of people wind up bums. They're too good to do anything, so they wind up doing nothing. They wind up living in their parents' house smoking dope. But they're waiting to, you know, be discovered. Everyone's got to sell out. You just got to, you know, just sell out for the highest price you can. That's the whole story.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Years, Barack Obama sat in his pew listening to his pastor.
And then wants us to sing God Bless America? No, no, no. Not God Bless America. God damn America. That's in the...
Now Beth Perdue and Richard Moore endorse Barack Obama. They should know better. He's just too extreme for North Carolina.
The North Carolina Republican Party sponsored this ad opposing Beth Perdue and Richard Moore for North Carolina governor.
There's no place in the Republican Party for the kind of ad that was put up by the North Carolina Republican Party. We communicated with them in the strongest possible terms not to run that ad. I cannot in my role dictate to the North Carolina Republican Party what their message is, but I can condemn it and I can appeal to the overwhelming majority of Republicans in the state of North Carolina who also repudiate that kind of activity. I'm calling on them to repudiate the people, the small handful of people that have refused to understand that we are the party of Abraham Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt, and Ronald Reagan. And that party...
All right, it's enough already. He ought to repudiate Obama's preacher rather than the Republican Party for exposing Reverend Wright. So, again, there's the John McCain that I can't support, to be honest with you. He's spending all this time and getting fire in his belly over attacking the Republican Party for running an ad that he should be thanking them for. He's not winning. If he continues this, it's over. He lost. If he hasn't learned... And the bartender who's running McCain's campaign has not learned from Pennsylvania that Hillary won by getting vicious. Remember, Hillary was not ahead in Pennsylvania. She was for a while, then it was neck and neck. And then all of a sudden, this stuff came up because they dug it up. Then they dug up the guns and religion stuff from the fundraiser in San Francisco. And suddenly she won by 10 points. And if McCain can't learn that you have to get down and dirty to win in the political arena, then how is he going to defend this against the enemies abroad? How is he going to do that if he's going to continue to think he can do it by compromising? He's mistaken. We don't need a compromising president. We need a tough-minded president able to street fight, and I don't think he's it. And that's why we're playing this over and over again on the Savage Nation, to show you that McCain's refrains are falling mainly down the drain, and I don't mean in Spain. We're also talking about the fact that the New York Times reporting today that even debt collection agencies are outsourcing their collection agents to India. And I'm asking, should U.S. companies be prohibited by federal law from outsourcing? It's got to stop. If this keeps up, there'll be nothing left. What jobs will be left in this country? So play the Bollywood music, and then we'll take your calls on the Savage Nation. Makes me laugh, makes me happy. Think of many a happy goat curry meals in Fiji with food poisoning afterwards. Many happy days spent on the loo in Fiji after eating a goat curry in a takeout stand. Now, what does George Bush have to say all about this outsourcing?
The United States is looking forward to eating Indian mangoes.
Take my mangoes, please. I love this music. I remember, I told you, many a happy night sitting in a rainy apartment in between plant collecting, washing the mud off my boots, listening to the Hindi music, no television, going out and drinking too much that night with my friends in the streets of Suva. It was fun. Why can't you mix science with a good time? Poor Donald did. I shouldn't talk about the dead. What happened to him? Can I talk about him? What if I don't mention his name? New story, actually. Look what just triggered in my mind. I knew a plant collector. No, I'd rather just do the pantomime. He died. It doesn't matter. It's water under the bridge. I haven't told the Fat Irving story. I haven't told the plant collector. There are stories. How do I have so many stories? How do I know so many things about people? My God, it's like Methuselah already. I started from the beginning. I'll do the thing that everyone wants to hear. My sister has Mercedes. Why no Mercedes? I'm translating roughly. It's a transliterate. It's a. I want E320. Sister has E320. She not as pretty. Why no Mercedes? You buy me Mercedes or you no get Kama Sutra tonight. No Kama Sutra. I want Mercedes 430. Oh, no Kama Sutra tonight. Now the male lead. This is the way they do it. And now the male comes in. Now he comes in. The guy sings now. Let's hear what he has to say. Natalia, you are pretty. I can only afford Opal. Cannot afford Mercedes. But if you cut off Nuki, if you cut off Kama Sutra, oh, I go crazy, crazy. Must have Kama Sutra. Constant Kama Sutra, it's in my gene. You got to give Kama Sutra, or I take away Opal. I admit I have sometimes a childish sense of humor, but it makes me happy. I hope it does you as well. Get it off already. No, it was funny. I think that's a very funny thing. 1-800-449-8255. Monterey, California. Carol, you're on the Savage Nation. What's on your mind?
I was just wondering. I really enjoyed your spaghetti story, and I was wondering if you could tell me your favorite Teddy tale, because I love it when you talk about Teddy.
Mm. Teddy's my 9-pound poodle, my miniature poodle. He is gray in color. My favorite story is that he loves spaghetti, and so I call him Spaghetti Teddy, and his favorite stunt is when I cook spaghetti, he'll stand on his hind legs, and if you know anything about poodles, they have interesting joints. They can stand straight up like a monkey, and he looks like a little bear, and he starts walking around the kitchen over to the spaghetti pot with his little paws hanging down in front on his hind legs like a bear, and I put noodles in his mouth. I hang the noodle down, and he literally sucks. I love dogs. I can't help it. He's my best friend. That's not a great story, but that's my current favorite Teddy story because it happened the other night. Does that work for you, the imagery?
That works for me, and I have to tell you, one time you made the comment that you didn't trust people who didn't have animals in their home, and I thought that was just so true.
Well, do I have to tell you that there are cab drivers in Minneapolis of a certain immigrant status who will not take even blind people with seeing-eye dogs because their religion considers it to be dirty? What does that tell you about them? I'm supposed to accept their retrograde view of the world instead of my compassionate view of the world? You're telling me we're supposed to tell blind people to stand in the slush because some bum from Somalia won't take him around because he has a twisted view of his own religion? Sorry, I don't see it that way. I'll be right back, though, with a great interview that I did earlier on terrorism, which I know is exactly what's the right medicine for this section. Savage. We'll be right back. not many of you understand how difficult it is to fight the war against radical Islamists, but our guest, Andrew C. McCarthy, does. He's a former federal prosecutor. He led the prosecution against the jihad organization of Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman, in which Islamic militants were convicted of conducting a war of urban terrorism against the United States, which included the 1993 World Trade Center bombings and a plot to bomb New York City. Landmarks, he's the author of Willful Blindness, A Memoir of the Jihad, and joins us now to talk about it. Andrew, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Dr. Savage, it's a great pleasure to be on with you. Thanks for inviting me.
Before we talk about your book, you recently wrote a National Review article on the company that Obama keeps.
Oh, with Ayers and Obama?
Could you tell us about it?
Okay, great. The article involved all of the variety of people that have come up in the news recently who Obama has been profoundly, I think, influenced by, beginning with his wife, Michelle, and cutting across to Reverend Wright, to Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn, who are terrorists, and I stress that they are terrorists, not terrorist sympathizers, but actual terrorists, and other people who he's been connected with in one way or another. Rashid Khalidi comes to mind.
Rashid Khalidi, the PLO operative?
He denies having been a member of the PLO, but certainly he was someone who was an apologist for Yasser Arafat, who is, of course, the master terrorist of the second half of the 20th century. And my take on it was that, really, if you look at all of these connections, there is a common thread that goes through all of them, and that is that he seems to be very comfortable with people who hate America and who are, and if you want to expand it, I guess, with Khalidi, who are who hate the West, and who are entirely too comfortable with revolutionary means of trying to accomplish their ends. So the article was actually an effort to try to thematically connect together the people who Obama seems very comfortable with.
Why was that important to you?
You know, I think it's important to try to get past the bombast that Obama's supporters bond with whenever you, you know, point out that this or that association of his has made comments that cast America in such a an unflattering light. You know, I don't think that you can just toss out Michelle Obama saying that, yes, she says things that cast America in a bad light, but, you know, they're not his words. And then they get to Reverend Wright and they say, well, that's guilt by association. And then they say the same thing about Dorn and Ayers. You know, I think that you need to ask why it is that Obama seems to draw these kinds of people around, and where the only common denominator seems to be that they all see America and American society as something which is, you know, as his wife has said, you know, downright mean. Ayers said, you know, something that makes him want to puke. You know, Dorn and Ayers obviously are people who took forcible action, atrocious forcible action against the country. And, you know, you have Wright, who thinks that 9/11 is something we should have figured we had coming, America's chickens coming home to roost.
I find these connections a little disturbing, don't you?
I think all this is extremely disturbing because, other than being a sort of an empty vessel that people have been able to project their hopes and aspirations on, we don't really know much about Barack Obama. He's been presented to us as kind of an amorphous character who really is presented to us behind these concepts like change and hope, where these concepts are sort of floated in the air, but there isn't a lot of detail behind them. And my suggestion is, looking at some of these connections and understanding that he seems to be quite comfortable with people who express those kinds of sentiments, these are people who wanted to radically change this country, whether by violence or stirring violence or by more soft means of revolutionary change. But they are people who, under the heading of social justice, want to bring radical change to the United States. And I think when Obama talks about change, given what his connections have been, given what his associations have been, I don't think that we can take that so lightly and that we ought to just let it go in one ear and out the other as just the usual political cant, because the people that he has surrounded himself with and been influenced by are people who want to profoundly change our country in a way that it would be unrecognizable from what it is now, and I think a change for the much worse.
I agree. Something isn't right here. Now, about your book, Willful Blindness, what prompted you to write the book?
Willful Blindness is really it's a memoir in the sense that it reflects some events that I had the privilege of participating in about 15 years ago, but it's more a story, not really a story about me, but a story about the challenge of Islamic terrorism that we have faced for, I think, reasonably you could say going back decades, but I would put the World Trade Center bombing of 1993 as certainly radical Islam's declaration of war against the United States. And I happen to have been the lead prosecutor in the seditious conspiracy case that we had against the blind sheikh, Omar Abdul Rahman, and about 11 other jihadists who not only were involved in the World Trade Center bombing, but after that bombing actually came up with an even more audacious plot to bomb New York City landmarks. They wanted to take out the Lincoln and Holland tunnels, the United Nations complex, and the FBI's headquarters in Lower Manhattan. When we finally were confronted by the bombing in a way that we actually had to look at and deal with radical Islam for the first time, what we regrettably found was that these people had really been plotting jihadist activity right under our noses after really starting up a beachhead in the New York, New Jersey area in the late 1980s. The plotters of the Trade Center bombing, for example, actually included Saeed Nosair, who committed one of the most famous homicides in the history of New York City in November of 1990 after a lecture. He actually, in a room full of people, walked up and shot Meir Kahani, the rabbi who was the founder of the Jewish Defense League and also was an Israeli legislator. He it was really a very brazen murder. He killed Kahani and then shot the 70-year-old man who was trying to block his way out of the doorway of the meeting hall and then ran out onto the streets of New York, where he ultimately had a shootout with a postal police officer whom he didn't kill only because the guy happened to be wearing his bulletproof vest and, you know, shot it out with Nosair until Nosair was finally taken down. He lived and not only ultimately was acquitted of the most serious charges against him, but also managed in the prison cell that he had in Attica Prison to plot a lot of the World Trade Center bombing with people who were involved in that attack who would come up and meet with him in Attica Prison.
Andrew, can you stay with us through the break?
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that.
We'll be right back with more from Andrew McCarthy.
Savage.
Talking with Andrew McCarthy about his book, Willful Blindness. So who is guilty of being willfully blind?
Well, you know, I think it would be easy to blame the government for its willful blindness. There certainly was enough of it. I mean, in the Nosair incident that I mentioned, there was a conscious decision made, even though there was immense evidence that he was a member of a much bigger Islamic terror network, to regard him as a lone crazed gunman and to discount the possibility that that was religiously motivated violence. You know, when you have a number of incidents like that over a number of years, and, you know, we have instances of the FBI conducting surveillance and shutting it down against these guys in the 1980s, we have the CIA basically providing funding for what turns out to be jihadist networks in Afghanistan in connection with the Mujahideen against the Russians in the 1980s, and then finally the business with Nosair and the lead up to the Trade Center bombing. You can look at and locate a lot of places where the government dropped the ball, but it's not just the government who really remains willfully blind. There's two things I think thematically I try to convey in the book. One is that we just simply have to come to terms with the fact that the ideology that is fueling all of the terrorism that has challenged us in the last 15 years is not, as we would like to think it is, some marginalized ideological code which is confined to a few fringe lunatics who have, as we like to put it, hijacked an otherwise peaceful religion. Radical Islam or fundamentalist Islam or political Islam or whatever it is that we're calling it this week to, you know, try to suggest that it's something other than Islam that is the root of all this. This particular strain of Islam goes back 14 centuries. It's a very systematic ideology. It's one that embraces not only religious principles, but also social and political principles. It strives to be an all-purpose system for living, not just a set of religious creed or religious principles. And importantly, it has commanded the fealty, the adherence of tens of millions of people, and still does, over the 14 centuries. It has commanded the fealty of rich and poor, old and young, educated and uneducated. I just think it's a terrible mistake for us to think that it's just a few fringe Looney Tunes who basically are responsible for all of the terror that we are confronted by. It's something that empirically doesn't make sense, since we've seen, you know, riots on demand and all kinds of terrorist acts globally for certainly the last 15 years. But it's also something that just simply is not true. There are tens of millions, probably hundreds of millions of people out of the total 1.4 billion of the world's Muslims who share this ideology. It doesn't mean that they will all become terrorists, but many people who would not themselves cross the line into terrorist activity actually do share the goals of the fundamentalists, which are to establish Sharia law in any place in the world where it's not established, as a preliminary measure to the reinstitution of the Islamic caliphate. And what they do target is basically the Western way of life. And the reason the United States is a big target is because we are deemed to be the number one obstacle to their ultimate goal.
You say the criminal justice system is not equipped to handle these problems?
Well, you're right. The second goal of the book, other than, or the second theme, I think, of the book, other than coming to grips with the Islamic ideology that is at the root of all this terrorism, is the fact that it's folly to think that you can protect a country, especially a country such as ours, by using the criminal justice system as the point of your counterterrorism spear. During the 8 years between the time the World Trade Center was bombed in 1993 until the complex was finally destroyed on 9/11, we had about 9 terrorism trials, and through those trials, we managed to take out exactly 29 terrorists in 8 years, during a period of time when the country was being audaciously attacked about once a year, attacks that, in ferocity, that led to ultimately the 9/11 attack, and a time during which our intelligence tells us that the enemy was not only getting more fierce and more bold, but also bigger. And I don't think that you can, you might be able to say that terrorism trials work as a matter of due process, if that's what your main concern is. You know, yes, we can bring terrorists into the system and give them a fair trial. But I think when most people in America are asked, does the criminal justice system work for terrorism, they mean as a counterterrorism strategy. And as a matter of national security, you can't have a situation where you have a deadly threat, which may actually even ultimately be an existential threat to the United States, have it challenge you the way that we were challenged throughout the 1990s, and content yourself with taking out 29 people in 8 years. And most of them, you know, but for a few exceptions, the lowest level terrorists. I frequently point out to people that, for example, Osama bin Laden's been under indictment in this country since June of 1998. That's before the bombings of the American embassies in East Africa, before the bombing of the USS Cole, before the Millennium plot on Los Angeles International Airport, and before 9/11. Adding additional counts to the indictment doesn't seem to have deterred him much. So you really can't have an effective national security strategy that relies too much on the criminal justice system. The criminal justice system has its role, but it can never be, I think, the paramount response. And, you know, look, since we've used the military after 9/11, you can argue that there's a lot of things that tactically and even strategically were dubious to do in the post 9/11 effort. I personally have my hesitation about this whole effort to democratize the Muslim world, which I think is a dubious project for a variety of reasons. But one thing you can argue with is that the best way of taking out terrorists is to capture or kill them. That is just simply a fact. And there have been many days in the last 7 years since 9/11 when we've taken out more people in a single day, killed and captured more people in a single day, whether it's in Iraq or Afghanistan, than were taken care of in the whole 8 years between 1993 and 2001. And when you ask yourself, you know, how come we haven't been attacked again since 9/11, you know, look, some of it is luck, but a lot of it is that we're actually killing and capturing the people who are threatening to us in a way that we didn't do in the 1990s. But the other real problem with using the criminal justice system is it's really counterintuitive if you think about it in terms of what your assumptions are when you use the criminal justice system versus what your assumption should be in the context of a national security problem. Our criminal justice system is the envy of the world precisely because we give defendants who are, you know, presumed to be, at least when the system is drawn up, you think that you're mostly going to be dealing with American citizens. It's the system that brings law and order to our own body politic. Our theory in it is that we would prefer to see government lose. That is, that we would actually prefer to see the guilty go free than have a situation where innocent people are railroaded. And as a result, the design of it is that you want to give every bounce of the ball to the defendants. You want to basically set up presumptions of innocence and privacy so that the government has a heavy burden before it can convict someone and remove his liberty or search somebody's house. You have to go through a court and persuade them that there's evidence of an actual crime before you're allowed to ransack somebody's home, for example, to try to collect evidence. We assign counsel to people in order to make sure the government's put to its maximum burden. And we really do those things precisely because we want to make sure before we take the liberty away, particularly from an American, that the government has satisfied members of the community that somebody warrants that type of treatment. So you're starting from a premise that you would rather see government lose than see somebody railroaded. I think that's a wonderful thing if you're dealing with people who are properly in our criminal justice system. But when you're dealing with a national security problem, people who are outside our body politic, who are foreign threats to the United States, who want to kill Americans, you simply can't take the position that we take in the criminal justice system that you would prefer to see government lose. That's a situation in which we have to want government to prevail, because if it doesn't, then the system that protects our civil liberties, the ones that we cherish, the ones that make America, America, if that system fails, those liberties aren't worth the paper they're written on. The problem that you have when you use the criminal justice system as, or, you know, when you treat your national security problems as if they were mere legal problems, is that you're actually using a variety of assumptions about how the people you're targeting should be treated, which were never intended to be used in the national security context, beginning with presuming your enemies, the people who mean you harm, to be innocent.
Andrew McCarthy, once again, God help us all, but thanks for being on the Savage Nation.
Thanks very much for your time. I appreciate it. I hope we get to do it again. Savage.
Speaking of terrorism, the Hitler of our time, Ahmadinejad of Iran, continues on his road to acquire a nuclear weapon and to use it on Israel. And Israel apparently is sitting there doing nothing. But are they doing nothing? Apparently, there's an interview coming up over the weekend that's going to play with the chief of Israel's Air Force, whose parents survived the German Holocaust against the Jews. And he's the general who is the chairman of the Israel, the leader of the Israel's Air Force, and he says that you must take Iran's threat seriously. And he said that if we don't, he said we could disappear. And here's, I'm going to quote him, it's coming up this Sunday. He said, "The general likens ignoring Ahmadinejad today to the atmosphere that enabled the Holocaust yesterday." Here's what he says. He says, "In those days, people didn't believe that Hitler was serious about what he said. I suggest not to repeat this way of thinking and to prepare ourselves for what they're planning. We should be prepared for everything." Now, let's get down to the brass tacks. You know that in 1981, the Israelis took out a nuclear reactor in Iraq. But the veterans of that particular mission, when comparing the situation to today, had this to say. He said, in that day, we had one point to destroy. Today, the Iranians have many points, many of them deep under the mountains, underground, and it's a much more complicated problem than in 1981. He says, I really hope it will be solved another way. There is only one thing worse than the Israel Air Force having to do it, and that is Iran having a nuclear bomb. So there it is. I mean, this is a real situation that's going to come to a head very soon. Now, those of you who read the Bible know that the Bible had some prophecies about this issue. And those of you who don't read the Bible better understand that all Israel has to do is lose one war to disappear, and that although Israel looks like a decadent Western nation right now, there's still a hardcore of Israelis who are not ready to roll over and sleep with their fraternity brother. And if the Iranians don't understand that they better leave Israel alone, and they don't remember what God promised, woe unto them. Because I'm sitting here and I'm telling you that in order for Israel to survive, they're going to have to do the maximum, and they're going to do it. On top of it all, if you watch the movements of ships, you know, Bush is kind of an interesting guy. You know, he looks like one thing, he may be another. We don't know if it's a game with him or who's doing it, but the U.S. just moved two new aircraft carrier groups into the area. Now, what are we moving these chess pieces around for? Are we just aircraft carrier rattling? Or do they really finally hope to use the F-A-18 Hornet the way they were designed to be used? Do we really intend finally to use our military the way it was designed to be used? What in the world is the military for, to wait until we're attacked? Or to attack them before they hit us? I don't understand it. You have a guy posturing over and over again saying, we're going to do Israel first, then you. Why do you let this man why do you let this Hitler get away with it? I keep screaming about this. I don't understand it. The man gets up and rages like Hitler on a regular basis. He appears with these retrograde throwback mullahs, and they scream, death to the West, death to Satan, blah, blah, blah. We could fire one cruise missile into the next speech he gives and wipe out the entire nest of hateful vermin. And I got news for you. The Iranian people would dance in the street. They'd be glad to be rid of them. I don't understand what our leadership is thinking. What are they afraid, that there'll be a bad article in Le Monde? They're afraid that Andrea Merkel may not like them? What in the world are we waiting for? Never mind another 9/11. Are we waiting for a nuclear bomb to go off somewhere in America before we do something? And then what? Are we going to invade Taiwan? That's my view. Mike, WOR, what's your view? Welcome to the Savage Nation.
Mike, I got to tell you, I love your show. I love your ideas. I'm retired, 20 years NYPD. I spent quite a few afternoons, evenings, and nights walking around picking up body parts down at 9/11. Okay, this stuff is real, and I think.
Well, you heard Mr. McCarthy. He's a former federal prosecutor, but his is like a voice in the wilderness, as is mine, Mike. The people don't care about this. They care about an upskirt shot on the internet of some slut in Hollywood. The country is hypnotized by the media. The media has been taken over by a madman from Australia who continues to throw panties in the face of the American people.
Well, I just am finishing up While Europe Slept by Bruce Bauer.
And okay. What's his premise about the 1930s in Europe, while Winston Churchill was trying to warn the British about what was coming, and they called him a reactionary fascist, the British did?
Exactly. And look at what's happening to all the social, political, and everything else over in that area. They're starting to really lose control of their areas, and by their...
That's right. The Muslims have taken over parts of London that the police are afraid to go into. Doesn't that sound like parts of America that the police are afraid of going to that are ruled by gangs from South America?
2017, they predict, is going to be the time that Sharia law is going to be in effect in a lot of areas of Europe. So,
you know, I doubt that you'll have Sharia law in America. You'll have revolution in this country before you let the politicians convert this country to Islam. I can guarantee you there'll be an armed uprising before this country rolls over like those cowards in Europe. It'll never happen here. It will never happen here, Mike.
I will be standing up there defending my country there, Mike. I've got my stuff, you know. anyway, Mr.
Yeah, we don't have to go there and start, you know, thumping our chest, but Europe is not America. America has a whole different set of traditions. America is armed to the teeth. The signal will be if one of these politicians, after winning the presidency, starts to go after the guns. That's the warning sign.
That's it. Exactly. Now,
and I'm not so sure it wouldn't be a Republican who does it rather than a Democrat. You know, I'm not so enamored of the Republican Party, as you well know. Thanks for the call. 1-800-449-8255, michaelsavage.com, michaelsavage.com, michaelsavage.com website. Grand Junction, Colorado. Mike, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Hey, Randy. Really have just become to love you over the past 4 years.
Good. I'm glad somebody does.
You know, you speak it hard and you speak it truthful. But
thank you.
I really believe right now that this is not about America. I think we've had our time. I'm a Christian man, and I have grown up to love the Jewish people. I really believe what America is going through right now. You know, that reverend that's with Obama that said the chickens are roosting or coming home.
Yes.
His hate speech was what it was, but what it is about, we have allowed this country to sit there and come from the place to where it was set there and made up for. And I believe it was always made up for because we're stepchildren. Christians are stepchildren. We are. God made that.
So you're saying that we're being punished because we've let the country become atheistic?
What I'm saying is we have allowed through Bill Clinton to allow the hateful people that sit there and hate the Jewish people to attack them. That's the only reason I truly believe.
Oh, wait, you mean the hateful people, you mean the radical Muslims?
Oh, no, not just the Muslims. I'm pretty sure that Bill Clinton had, his name is telling me now, but the Palestinian guy.
Well, but George Bush today wants a Palestinian state, so you can't lay the blame at Bill Clinton's door. Mike, I don't mean to be rude right now, but we are just about out of time, down to 30 seconds on the Savage Nation. And again, I advise that you just keep your eyes tuned. Things are changing rapidly. We have a currency crisis. We have a commodity crisis. We have a border crisis. And we have a media crisis where you have psychotic, pathologically ill people in the media who refuse to ask one serious question about the most important problems of our time of any of the candidates, instead throwing fluff and smoke in your face. And that is because of the media falling into the hands of the wrong people. You must fight this media consolidation.
Savage.